Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll have the fall culture preview. We'll dip into our archives to hear the story of Denton author Sophie Kerr, and naturalist Dave Wilson, along with a couple of his friends, will tell us about one of Maryland's wildlife icons, the diamondback terrapin. Fall is perhaps the best time to get your culture fix on Delmarva. There's so much going on. The big kickoff every year seems to be the last weekend in September. That's the weekend of Sunfest at the Ocean City Inlet parking lot with four fun-filled days of music, food, arts, and crafts. It's also the weekend of the annual Berlin Fiddlers Convention, where downtown Berlin is blocked off for concerts and competitions between amazing bluegrass musicians of all ages. It is free, just bring your own seating. While you're there, you also see talented visual artists from across the region. They're there to compete in the Paint Berlin 6th Annual Plein Air Show at the Worcester County Arts Council. And in Hartley, Delaware, that weekend is the 25th Annual Delmarva Folk Festival with 2 days of music, camping, and family fun. If you want to see really great fine art, then there are wonderful exhibits all over Delmarva this fall. For the next 3 months, Art in the Fields Gallery in Berlin will feature prints by 20th century artists including René Genis, Ilya Bolotowski, and the king of Art Deco, Erte. Also during that time, you can see the Harvest Art Show at the Mispillion Art League Gallery in Milford. At Bishop Stock in Snow Hill, the September featured artist will be painter Jim Rehack, followed in October by Martha Graham and Louise Dozenbear, and Scott Dolby in November. Art shows in September include the Handmade in America exhibition at the River Arts Gallery in Chestertown, where they'll have a variety of work created by local and regional artists in ceramics, metal, jewelry, fiber arts, and wood in both small and large scale. This month at the Gibby Center for the Arts in Middletown, Delaware, it is the Guild by Association annual members exhibit. Also during September, the Rehoboth Art League will have their 7th Regional Juried Biennial exhibition, and artist Robert Rath will discuss his project, Pieces That Remain, Steel from the World Trade Center. Saturday, September 17th is the first ever Downtown Festival of the Arts in Elkton. September 25th is the Dorchester Center for the Arts Showcase in Cambridge. And beginning September 27th, see the exhibit titled Dwellings at the Newark Arts Alliance in Newark, Delaware. The Milford Arts Community will celebrate the nationwide American Crafts Week October 1st through the 15th. All during October at the Mosley Gallery on the campus of UMES in Princess Anne, you can see 30 Years of Comics by Paris Cullins, creator of DC Comics' Blue Devil. This will be followed in November by Cheryl Namazi, photography. The October exhibits at the Ocean City Center for the Arts will include an abstract show. Featured artists will be Evan Fitzgerald, Damon Plaugh, Maria Gayhart, and Dot and Bob Truitt. In November, they'll have their members' juried show, students of Barbara Doyle Schmid, and work by Debbie Dean Coley, Ashley Brown, and Kathy Hugel. Also in November, see the Small Wonders juried exhibit at the Worcester County Arts Council in Berlin. Like the visual arts, there is a great deal of music to enjoy here this fall. Many of our clubs and commercial concert venues have great lineups. Beginning this month, both Salisbury University and Washington College will start their fall concert series. Both have an impressive list of live concerts being given by diverse and world-renowned artists, performing everything from classical to world music, hip-hop, and bluegrass. Many, though not all, these events are free. On September 17th, the American Spiritual Ensemble will perform at the Asbury Church in Salisbury. September 21st is Blues on the Bay at Mackey's Bayside Bar and Grill in Ocean City, the proceeds of which will go toward building a coastal hospice at the ocean. The Mid-Atlantic Symphony Orchestra will start their fall season on Delmarva September 29th at Easton Church of God and October 2nd at the Ocean City Performing Arts Center with Of Tragedy, Love, and Victory. This will include Guillemont's Symphony No. 1, Wagner's Tannhauser Overture, and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4. On October 1st, the United States Marine Band will perform at the Ella Fitzgerald Center at UMES in Princess Anne. That day is also the monthly First Saturday event in Salisbury featuring the Saltwater String Band. And on October 14th, it's the beginning of the Fall and Winter Concert Series by the Delaware Friends of Folk and First Heritage Park in Dover, Delaware. There really is nothing like live music or theater. The annual free Shakespeare production given by the Brown Box Theater will be the romantic drama Cymbeline. Bring your own seating when the players come to Salisbury, Snow Hill, Chincoteague, Berlin, Ocean Pines, Pocomoke City, Rehoboth Beach, Ocean City, St. Michael's, Princess Anne, Chesapeake City, and Lewis. Salisbury University's fall theater season includes The Country Wife, presented in October, and Clybourne Park in November. Also in Salisbury, the Community Players will bring Beauty and the Beast to the stage in November. The fall season of the Prince Theater in Chestertown will include productions of A Delicate Balance and The 39 Steps. And the Second Street Players in Milford will present productions of Blithe Spirit and Charlotte's Web this fall. There is a variety of home, food, and garden events this fall. September 18th is Eat in the Street in Milford, featuring a farm-to-table dinner served at a long harvest table down the middle of Walnut Street. September 22nd and 23rd is the annual Sandcastle Home Tour presented by the Ocean City Art League, featuring 10 beautiful homes in the Ocean City area. September 24th is Farm to Fork at Sanger Barn in Centerville, with dinner by Paul Gunther Catering, music, square dancing, and a raffle. Also on September 24th, check out Dock on the Bay at Summers Cove Marina in Crisfield, with historic fishing vessels, seafood cooking and catching demonstrations, live music, and a Blessing of the Fleet ceremony. October 9th is the Milford International Food Festival. Whether your heritage is German or something else, if you enjoy beer, check out Berlin, Maryland's Oktoberfest, October 15th. They'll have German bands, local brews, and lots of fun. For more beer celebration, October 29th is the Shorecraft Beer Fest at Sunset Park in Ocean City. Also in OC that weekend is the Autumn Arts and Crafts Fair and Home and Condo Show at the Ocean City Convention Center. Many events this fall celebrate our local heritage. On October 1st at First State Heritage Park in Dover, enjoy a day of historic theater vignettes and other heritage programs about some of Dover's influential families from the past 300 years. That weekend is also the Chesapeake Celtic Festival, when Furnacetown will be transformed into Brigadoon with flags and banners flying, sounds of bagpipe music and dancing feet, and the wonderful smells and taste of Celtic food and drink. October 8th, visit the Ward Museum in Salisbury for the Chesapeake Wildfowl Expo. As you're listening to this, the 39th annual Nanticoke Powwow is going on right now in Millsboro, Delaware. Today and tomorrow, they'll have traditional dance performances, food, and crafts. If you miss it, next month on October 15th and 16th, check out the Akahonic Tribe's 23rd Annual Healing of All Nations Festival and Powwow. That's at Bendingwater Park in Marion. October 24th through the 31st is the Ocean City Life Saving Station Museum's 7th Annual Locals Appreciation Week, with free admission. One of the most interesting heritage festivals here on the peninsula each fall is the Sultana Downrigging Weekend, October 28th through the 30th in Chestertown. This tall ship and wooden boat festival is now in its 16th year. See the waterfront packed with schooners and other wooden boats. Listen to performances by world-class musicians and hear fascinating lectures by nationally recognized authors and filmmakers. Halloween weekend has many spooky events where you can have fun, but also learn about our local history. There are numerous Chesapeake ghost walks held around the peninsula and heritage lantern tours in Dover. One of the bigger Halloween celebrations that weekend is the Sea Witch Festival that spreads across Rehoboth and Dewey Beaches, where they'll have guided heritage hikes, a parade, pony rides, games, a Fiddler's Bluegrass Festival, and much more family fun. On November 1st, Salisbury University Art Galleries will feature filmmaker Chris Lynn and a selection of short films shot in Chance and Deal Island. November 5th is the 7th annual 18th Century Market Fair on the Green in Dover. Also in Dover that day, learn about tracing your roots with local genealogist Judy Russell. The next weekend, November 11th through the 13th, is the Easton Waterfowl Festival. This highly regarded annual event is dedicated to wildlife conservation and art, and to celebrating life on Maryland's eastern shore. There certainly is a lot to celebrate all over the peninsula. If anyone tells you that Delmarva is a cultural backwater, they are sadly mistaken. We have everything from highbrow to lowbrow art and entertainment. And all these events that I just told you about are just a fraction of what is happening here. Get links and details for these and many more at delmarvaalmanac.com/events. It's time for a break now. When we come back, we'll dip into our archives to hear the story of Denton author Sophie Kerr. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe. Every year, Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, awards the Sophie Kerr Prize to their graduating senior who is deemed to have the most literary promise. This gets a lot of press for being the largest such prize for an undergraduate in the world. This year, over $65,000 was awarded to a Westminster, Maryland resident, Riley D. Cox, for his poetry. That amount is especially impressive since both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award each only give individual winners $10,000. But who was Sophie Kerr? The benefactor of the Kerr Prize was born August 23, 1880, and raised in Denton, Maryland. Sophie's father was a locally respected nurseryman and horticulturalist. Sophie said that growing up, she had an unfettered encouragement to read to her heart's content. The passion she had for this activity stayed with her the rest of her life. Sophie received an undergraduate degree from Hood College, where she began her writing. But she was rather dismissive of her teachers up to that point. She went on to graduate studies at the University of Vermont, where she met a teacher who she did not dismiss, Professor Samuel Emerson. He made her realize that, quote, "I did not know how to use my mind, and that my education was of the most shocking superficiality. I learned that I did not know how to think," unquote. She forlornly came to the conclusion that she did not have the proper training to become the great intellectual she had hoped to be. Sophie wrote, "But I did at least get this, the habit of thinking things out for myself. A poor opinion thought out by the individual is better than a lazy acceptance of someone else's say-so." Meanwhile, Sophie had been bitten by the writing bug. She said, "When I graduated from college, I was just 18, and I came home and I told my father that I was going to be an author, and he might as well buy me a typewriter. I was always of a severely practical turn of mind." She got her typewriter and began writing and submitting short stories to magazines. In 1904, Sophie married a civil engineer named John Underwood. Not much has been written about this union, except that it ended in divorce after only 4 years. She continued to write under both her given name of Kerr and that she got from her brief marriage, Kerr Underwood. Maybe this was for propriety's sake, or maybe it was because she owned an Underwood typewriter and enjoyed the play on words of being a writer named Underwood. Regardless, picking up and moving on, Sophie began to write society stories about her trips to Washington and Baltimore, which were published by the Pittsburgh Gazette. She parlayed that into a job running that paper's women's page. There she learned the art of editing while continuing to sell her short fiction pieces to magazines around the country. In the 20s, these were all the rage, the equivalent of TV shows or today's podcasts. Sophie took her successes and went to New York. There she applied for a job at a publication called the Women's Home Companion. She got the job, and eventually she became its editor. This remained her day job for the rest of her career. It's interesting to note that at this point in the early 20th century, writing was becoming a sort of national pastime, which she was a little bit ambivalent about. Sophie wrote, "I believe that there was never a time when so many people were writing and writing well, but saying nothing of value. On the other hand, I believe there is a lot of big stuff being done, and that the mediocre stuff doesn't really obscure it." Those conditions could be said to prevail even today. You're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kester McCabe, and this is the story of writer and Denton native Sophie Kerr. Sophie was a very prolific, commercial writer. She wrote about everything from cooking and gardening to politics. She was a music critic. She wrote over 500 short stories, 23 novels, several poems, and a handful of plays. Her work was made into a few movies and television shows and even produced on Broadway. She had a strong following. Most of her fiction was written about women who had experiences similar to her own. They were often career girls with wit and determination. They were the epitome of what modern young women of the early 20th century wanted to be. She told stories of ladies taking a stand, demanding respect within their marriages and at their jobs. Some were good girls and some were very bad. Sophie knew what her audience liked. In other words, what would sell in that contemporary marketplace. She knew what young women in particular wanted to read. Yet her own reflection on her work suggests Sophie did not necessarily write to advance a feminist agenda. She said, "Furthermore, what my various characters say does not necessarily reflect on my own view or beliefs. I have no propaganda spirit. The story's the thing." Time and time again have indignant readers berated me for beliefs which were at wide variance with my own, but perfectly in keeping with the character who expressed them. Sophie's fiction might have been dismissed as the chick lit of her day. Just the same, when she wrote a novel called The Golden Block, it was clearly advancing the cause of women in the workplace. This was the story of a successful woman executive who starts out as a secretary at a construction company and who works her way up to running it. The female lead, facing those who are skeptical whether a woman is smart enough to succeed, says, "There's no sex in brains. You've got to play a perfectly merciless game of give and take, for that's modern business." The book received mixed reviews. Some critics praised the bravado of Sophie's heroine, while others said that she had abandoned her morals. Another said Sophie had done nothing in this book to clarify feminism. Still others praised the novel, saying that unlike other authors' women characters, hers made things happen rather than waiting for things to happen to them. Sophie lived most of her life in a brownstone at 115 East 38th Street in Manhattan, where she entertained her literary and theatrical friends. She always kept cats, including two which she wrote about, named Useless and Worthless. Her family home in Denton, the Sophie Kerr House, still exists. It was a bed and breakfast in the 1980s, but currently is a private residence. After her parents died and the homestead was sold, she is said to have summered in Denton, staying at the Brick Hotel. Some thought she based her book One Thing is Certain on the people there, but she claimed that she never used real people's lives in her stories. As she got older, Sophie was free with her advice and encouragement for other writers. One co-worker said that as an editor, she was a stronghold of comfort. In an interview, Sophie suggested that neophyte writers should write as much as they could and learn to type so they could get a job doing secretarial work at local newspapers in order to get their foot in the door. In 1942, Sophie was awarded an honorary degree from Washington College along with Eleanor Roosevelt. This was the 50th anniversary of women's acceptance at the college. Though she received other degrees from other institutions, it was probably her affection for the region she grew up in which led her to bequeath most of her estate to Washington College when she passed away in 1965 at the age of 85. Each year, her gift continues to fund scholarships, book purchases, special events, and the literary prize given in her name. The bequest has also funded writing workshops for Washington College students by visiting literary giants like Katherine Porter, Edward Albee, and Toni Morrison. The Sophie Kerr Prize was first awarded in 1968. There has been some talk of a curse associated with the prize, since few of its recipients have risen to great acclaim as writers. But to date, 48 individuals have used the money to further their education and to start off their lives as adults, hopefully, as Sophie would say, without the lazy acceptance of someone else's say-so. Find out more about Sophie Kerr and get links to some of her short stories online on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. September has been perhaps the worst month for tropical storms and hurricanes on Delmarva, especially in the days of wooden sailing ships. On September 10, 1888, the British schooner Elk ran aground and was stranded on Paramore Beach, Virginia. Despite the heavy storm, all hands were rescued. But on September 15th, 1903, during a deadly hurricane, five perished from the schooner Hattie A. Marsh when it broke up along the Delaware Capes. During that same storm on the Wicomico River in Salisbury, several schooners broke from their moorings and they were smashed downstream. And a bit north of Chincoteague, the fishing schooner Beatrice was lost, taking with it a crew of 30 hands. It's time for a break now. When we come back, naturalist Dave Wilson and a couple of his friends will tell us about the diamondback terrapin.
The best way to experience the waters of Delmarva is by paddling, by kayak, canoe, and stand-up paddleboard. During the Delmarva Paddling Weekend, September 30th through October 2nd, join the expert guides leading trips around Laurel, Delaware, and Snow Hill, Maryland. For more information, please visit delmarvapaddling.com.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. Now here's naturalist Dave Wilson and a couple of friends to tell us about the diamondback terrapin.
My guest today is Scott Smith, with Jen Rafter from the Maryland Coastal Bays Program. Scott is a wildlife ecologist for DNR's Natural Heritage Program, where he has worked with birds, reptiles, and amphibians for 26 years. Jen Rafter is the technical coordinator for the Maryland Coastal Bays Program. She oversees their terrapin monitoring program, as well as tracking the program's environmental progress and coordinating climate adaptation and resilience activities. You two, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Scott, I want to start with you. Can you discuss the biology of terrapins, sort of what they eat, where they live, where they go in the winter?
The diamondback terrapin is our only species that lives in brackish water, in salt ponds, salt marshes, near the beach. Terrapins are adapted to excrete the excess salt in their system, which would be lethal to a lot of other turtle species. They have really three main habitat criteria. They need sandy beach areas for nesting. They need marsh habitat for the juveniles and for feeding, and they need open water areas, deeper open water for females and near shore areas for males and the juveniles.
Can you talk a little bit about what terrapins eat?
Sure. Terrapins are kind of a diet specialist. They're what we call a molluscivore. That means they feed on mollusks or shellfish. And so snails and clams and mussels are a big part of their diet. They'll also opportunistically feed on a lot of other things, such as different types of crabs. There's even some suggestion that they will intake eelgrass seeds while they're feeding on other things, and they're responsible for helping spread eelgrass around in the marsh area.
Terrapins have quite a history in Maryland. Can you talk about that, plus what precipitated the ban on harvesting?
Sure. Native Americans ate terrapins. They certainly use them in some of the rituals. And then when the North America was colonized by Europeans, Europeans also quickly adapted to eating them like the Native Americans. But also there became a commercial harvest of them. Around the turn of last century, the late 1800s, early 1900s, terrapins were a gourmet treat in the finest restaurants worldwide. And because of over-harvesting, their numbers went down. And so for quite a period of time, around the 1920s, the populations had pretty much plummeted.
How does DNR keep track of their populations in the state?
So we have a number of ways we keep track of terrapins. First off, we have a really great relationship with Dr. Willem Rosenberg from Ohio University, who's been studying terrapins in Maryland for 25 plus years, starting with a long-term population study in the Patuxent River, and now he's working at Poplar Island in Talbot County. Turtle populations are hard to track their trends unless you really track them over long periods of time because they are so long-lived. So there is huge value for us in looking at his data and him sharing his data with us. We also have been coordinating a statewide terrapin headcount survey where scientists and citizen scientists go out on the water in boats and count terrapins in the spring.
Yeah, I know one of the things that precipitated that was the concern about crab pots and they're getting caught and killed in crab pots. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the crab pot that we use now was first developed in Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, and then it was adopted in the 1940s here in Maryland. And right off the bat, watermen noticed that it was drowning and killing terrapins and other fish and other things. And so initially, its use was banned in the 1940s by the legislature. And then when it came back into use a couple of years later, it was only allowed to be used in deeper water habitats. So like right now in our regulations, DNR regulations, from a commercial standpoint, crab pots can't be used in water that's less than 4 feet deep. And so the idea there is to keep them out in deeper water where you're not going to impact the larger number of terrapins. However, in the 1970s, regulations were passed that allowed their use by recreational crabbers, i.e. shoreline landowners, in those same tributaries where we know we have large terrapin populations. And thus, over the years, there's been many records and reports of crab pots being filled with dead terrapins. And so in 1999, after research done again by Dr. Rosenberg, we adapted regulations to require terrapin excluder devices, or what we call BRDs, bycatch reduction devices, from recreational crab pots. And those have been a help, but our problem right now is we're not seeing as much use by the public as we'd like.
Jen, can you tell me a little bit about the Maryland Coastal Bays program work with terrapins?
Sure. Since 2011, as part of the Maryland Terrapin Working Group that Scott heads, the Maryland Coastal Bays program has helped to organize volunteers for citizen science terrapin surveys. We do these surveys in the spring when the terrapins emerge, usually the week after Memorial Day. This spring, 27 volunteers sighted over 400 terrapins, and the surveys take place by motorboat or kayak, canoe, even stand-up paddle boards. And also, for the past 2 years, people have done land surveys using spotting scopes.
Is there an easy way for folks to get involved in that? Is there a website or a phone number?
Sure. You can give me an email at jrafter@mdcoastalbays.org or call 410-213-2297, extension 105. And you can also go to mdcoastalbays.org, and there is a link on our homepage for the Terrapin Project.
How about turtle excluder devices? Is there a way to get those on crab pots if people are interested?
That's a great question. Maryland Coastal Bays Program actually has free bycatch reduction devices or terrapin excluder devices through a grant from the Community Foundation of the Eastern Shore. And if you're interested in getting some of those, give Sandy an email at sandis@mdcoastalbays.org, and we would be happy to help you out with those as long as supplies last.
We've been talking to Scott Smith with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and Jen Rafter at the Maryland Coastal Bays Program about terrapins today. For more information on terrapins and their habitats and what you can do to help terrapins, go to delmarvaalmanac.com/nature.
Thanks, Dave. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.